Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted that Bremont will be sponsoring the Money Maze podcast throughout this year. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont. If I were not a physicist, I would probably be a musician. I often think in music. I live my daydreams in music. I see my life in terms of music. Well, that's not a David Bowie quote. That was actually Albert Einstein. So yes, we're talking music today. Well, I'm not going to be talking about music, but my guest is, because he has worked with the greats, from Elton John to Beyoncé. He's been in the business for nearly 40 years, and in his current business works with the likes of Barry Manilow, Chrissy Hynde, Debbie Harry, Fleetwood Mac, B-52s and Michael Bublé. And with Vivendi spinning out Universal Music to capitalize on the rising value of music assets and investment vehicles being rolled out globally to offer investors access to this category, I'm thrilled to have the Chief Executive Officer of Hypnosis Songs Funds Limited, a FTSE 250 company and the first UK investment company offering a pure play exposure to songs and music IP. So all the way from LA, Merck Mercuriadis, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Simon, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Great. Well, one of the reasons I'm particularly happy is that I see that you were born in the same year as me. So it's the first guest I think I've had who's as old as me.
Ah, well, that's the beauty of music. It keeps you young.
Fantastic. Well, I'd like to rewind because, of course, the question that was teasing me throughout this research was, were you a musical child? Were you from a musical family?
No, I grew up in Canada. I live in London, but I'm in Los Angeles at the moment for lockdown. But I grew up in Canada. And I was very famously asked by my grade three. So grade three would be approximately 8 years old. My grade three music teacher was this wonderful Scottish lady called Miss McLean. And she had a big reel-to-reel tape recorder. This is around 1970 or so, 71. And she's got Abbey Road on this reel-to-reel, and she's got the original London cast of Jesus Christ Superstar, and she's got South African folk songs like We're Marching to Pretoria and such like. And I love her class because she plays this music, and she teaches us about melody, and she teaches us about rhythm, and I'm doing my bit. And one day she asks me to stay behind, and I'm thinking that I'm going to get some sort of reward for my magnificent ability. And she asked me to never come back. she basically says, listen, you're way too disruptive. You need to, we can't afford to have you in this class. You make too much noise. You don't know what the beat is. You know, you have no idea where the melody is going. So that was a bit of a heartbreak. But to be honest with you, I knew by that time that I wanted to work in music, but equally well, I knew that I was never going to be Neil Young or Jimmy Page or Robert Plant, that I was going to be somebody that would surround these people and play a different role. So I was very fortunate to have a great library nearby, and I just started to read biographies and autobiographies of people that were making music and figuring out who the other people were that were in their lives. And that set me on a path that I think officially started work when I was 16, going on 17 and just about 17 years old, and just went from there.
So the story I read was at the age of 12, you traveled 160 kilometers from your hometown to see Kiss play in Halifax. And that was a real inspiration. Is that apocryphal or is that true?
No, no, it's 100% true without question. And I've been very blessed all these years later to have worked with Gene and Paul and Kiss many, many times. But it was the first gig that I ever went to. My father pulled up to the arena and said, look, you know, whatever happens, you need to be out and you need to be at this spot so I can pick you up and take you home at X time, whatever it was. And it was Kiss with Cheap Trick supporting. And it was an incredible moment for me because I was able to work my way down pretty much to the front. I was surrounded by other people that loved music in the same way that I did. And I can very vividly remember talking to these two guys that were older than I was. And we were talking about records. And I can remember that we talked about Jeff Beck's live album with Jan Hammer and Led Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti, which hadn't been out for very long at that point. And these two older guys, they decided to sort of see how smart I really was. And they said, listen, what do you think of the third New York Dolls album? And I was very able and very excited to say, because I knew they were trying to trick me, that there isn't a third New York Dolls album. There's only the New York Dolls and Too Much Too Soon. And these guys being older, they kind of gave me the 1975-76 equivalent of a high five, and they patted me on the back. And it was a sort of validation of my musical knowledge and that my passion was going in the right direction.
That is great. I have to share a story that sort of come to me, and it would have been a similar time. I come from Bristol. The Clash were playing in Bristol. I spiked my hair with sugar and water, and I wore some pair of monkey boots. And my father came back and I said, could you give me a lift to the concert? And he said, dress like that, you're taking public transport.
I consider myself to be a child of the Clash. There are very, very few people that are as influential as Joe Strummer and Mick Jones as far as my life is concerned. And certainly they define my ideals. And, you know, that's one of the wonderful things about music is that people say and do things that you either admire or that you laugh at. And those people that you admire and that conduct themselves in a certain way, and it could be Bob Marley, it could be Bruce Springsteen, it could be Neil Young, it could be Joe and Mick from The Clash, they set a tone for the rest of your life. And their music is a part of the fabric of your life, and it stays with you forever. So when I came to the city to look to the financial community to support the idea of songs as a new asset class, the first thing that I talked about was that these revenues from these incredible songs are very predictable and reliable because they are part of the fabric of your life. So if you were a 14-year-old girl and you had your first crush on a boy to Eurythmics' Sweet Dreams Are Made of This in 1982, you're now 53 years old. And that song has been with you your entire life through the good times and the bad. And that's what gives you these predictable, reliable income streams from these incredible songs.
Yeah. Now, my wife plays that song a bit, but I don't think it's a reminder of me. So I'll have to just check that out later on. But
yeah, you should find out just who it is that inspires the push play on Sweet Dreams Are Made of This.
So I believe that you were a real example of why persistence pays, because you get a job with Virgin Records after bombarding them with letters and calls. Is that right?
Yeah, it's very important to say Richard Branson's Virgin Records, because the company that Richard created, the musical genius in that company was a guy called Simon Draper, who was Richard's cousin. The company just had incredible taste. It signed some of the finest artists of the 70s and the early 80s. And it was also a very, very artist-friendly company. So people wanted to be there. And an artist would sign to Simon Draper for less money than they would sign to another company, because they knew that culturally it was where they wanted to be and that they would have the opportunity to develop and to grow into greatness. And what happened was that this is a company that releases its first record, Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, that becomes one of the biggest records of all time. But beyond that, in the first sort of 7 years of the company, the taste was pretty obscure. The Sex Pistols were about as commercial as it got once you got past Mike Oldfield. But by the time you get to the early 80s, which is my time, the company is signing artists like Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark and Simple Minds and Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins and XTC and the Human League, and probably most famously in terms of commercial success at the time, Culture Club, that literally became the biggest band in the world with their first two records. So it was an amazing time to be at a company that culturally was left of center, but at the same time releasing incredibly commercial music as well and pushing the envelope. But it was a rude awakening for me because I was not sophisticated and I was naive enough to believe that working for Richard Branson was the same thing as working for the artist. And probably 60 or 70% of the time that was true, but crucially 30 or 40% of the time there wasn't alignment there, and what was in the best interest of the artist wasn't necessarily what was in the best interest of Richard Branson. Or certainly you could look at it from the point of view of what the artist wanted wasn't necessarily in the best interest of Richard Branson and Virgin Records. So once I became woke or sophisticated enough to figure that out, I then became a manager. I wanted to make my money and my reputation with artists and songwriters and producers. So these two guys, Rod Smallwood and Andy Taylor, were managing Iron Maiden, and Iron Maiden were starting to have really serious success. And they were both 15 years older than I was. They were the most ideal pair in the world because one of them knew everything there was to know about business. The other one knew everything there was to know about creativity. One of them loved sport. The other one hated sport. The only thing that they really had in common was that they both loved drink, but one of them could drink and remember the finest points of a 70-page contract, and the other one wouldn't remember a thing the next day, other than the fact that there was a gig that we had to go to. And I, other than the fact that I didn't drink, I became the bastard offspring of the both, learning both the best of business and the best of creativity from each of them. And that really was the transformative time of my career. We were together for 20 years, and the artists that I had the privilege of working with in that period of time, including Elton, including Iron Maiden, including Morrissey and Guns N' Roses and Beyonce, were artists that I cut my teeth with and that thankfully allowed me to create the reputation that I've created in this business, which is being somebody that, as I say, has made their success with the artist, the songwriter, and the producer.
Got it. So then 10 years later, 1997, the Bowie Bond comes along. And for those who maybe are less familiar, it was David Bowie and the Prudential Corporation essentially set up the first security-backed bond, $55 million coming from the cash flow. And I'm just wondering, at that point, did you all suddenly say, oh, hang on, something's changing in the industry?
No, I didn't at that point. What I could see changing in the industry at that point was something very different, which in many ways plays into the hypnosis construct, which was that consolidation was not the best friend of the artist, because ultimately these companies were being reduced to small workforces that had thousands of options. We now sit here today and look at one of the big differences between hypnosis and its competitors is that we're able to manage these songs better than they've been managed previously, because our model is entirely different. Our model is to be able to actively put the songs in movies, TV commercials, video games, have new songwriters interpolate them, have new artists cover them. And we've got the bandwidth to do it because we operate on less than 1,000 songs per person, between 500 songs and 1,000 songs per person. The big companies have 20,000 songs per person. And that all started with this consolidation of these great companies in the early 90s, where you literally had, in the space of about 3 or 4 years, about 35 or 40 record companies and publishers effectively reduced down to 5. So their ability to be able to prioritize and then add value was minimized severely because they could only focus on 2 or 3 projects at a time.
So we're going to talk about the vision for the company in a minute, but I just want to pause because the music industry suddenly meets streaming. And I guess that I was surprised as I did my research that almost every US household today has a music streaming subscription. So is it shifted from a sort of a luxury buy a CD once every week to a utility?
That's it, exactly. When I came to the market with the initial meetings almost 4 years ago, what I explained to these great institutional investors that I was meeting with was that on the one hand, as I say, these songs have very predictable, reliable income because we only buy proven songs. We're not in the business of buying anything that isn't already extraordinarily successful and of great cultural importance. So when you look at these incredible catalogs, Neil Young, that we have, Lindsey Buckingham, Cher, Fleetwood Mac, people like Timbaland, people like Mark Ronson, people like Journey and Don't Stop Believing, which today just hit 1 billion streams and is the only song of pre-2000 to hit 1 billion streams besides Bohemian Rhapsody. So it's now the biggest song of the 80s and arguably the biggest song of the last century. These are all songs of not only predictable, reliable income, but of great cultural importance as well. And that way they endure. One of the things that's attractive about this as an asset class is that it's protected by rule of law, which is 70 years after the death of the last Coke composer. So our catalog has an average lifespan of 100 years of earnings on something that we paid an average of 15.6 times for. So when I came to the market, I explained that these songs were available at attractive prices because we had 16 years of technological disruption between 2001 and 2016 that effectively meant that people like you and I could consume music for free via illegal downloading. The only thing good that came out of that, it almost killed the business. It left it on its hind legs. The only thing good that came out of that was that it left these songs at attractive prices at a point in time where that technology was evolving into streaming, and streaming was making it once again more convenient for people to consume music legally and to pay for it. So when we started Hypnosis, we had 30 million paid subscribers around the world. Today, we have 450 million paid subscribers around the world, and we're projected to have as many as 2 billion by the end of the decade. Now, within that is exactly the point that you were making, which is that the benchmark for extraordinary success in our business used to be the platinum record. And if we use the United States as a microcosm, that's 1 million copies sold in a country that has 350 million people in it. That immediately tells you that the average person, albeit they might love music, didn't love it enough to pay for it. Now, those other 349 out of 350 people that weren't payers before, the vast majority of them are paying $120 a year, £120 a year for music. And we very much have gone from that benchmark of extraordinary success being 1 million copies in a country that has 350 million people to now having 100 million homes in that same country that are all each paying for a premium music subscription. So one of the things that, again, makes this such an attractive proposition for our shareholders is that as a result of that, the quality of earnings is much higher because you've got present value and you've got low interest rates. And ultimately, what you've got is very, very certain income streams now as a result of going from being a discretionary luxury purchase to being a utility. So you're also seeing the discount rate on which these catalogs are valued coming down significantly. So in our first five reporting periods, we have a requirement to have our net asset value done semi-annually by an independent valuer. The discount rate in the first 4 out of 5 periods was 9%. It's now come down to 8.5%. That's boosted the value of our catalog by 9%. And equally well, at the same time, the guru of this methodology, who's a guy called Professor Aswath Damodaran at NYU Stern, has narrowed the discount rate for 2021 to 4.82% on entertainment. So this is going to have, again, some further impact on the value of our catalogs.
So I guess people listening, like many like myself, will be paying their 10 or 12 pounds a month for whatever sort of family account or joint account or, but how does that typically get split between the songwriter, singer, and the company?
I created Hypnosis with a motive, and the motive was to make money for our shareholders, give them a great return on their investment, establish songs as an asset class. But then equally well, there's an ulterior motive, and the ulterior motive is to change where the songwriter sits in the economic equation and to use our success, our financial wherewithal, and the leverage of our great songs to be a catalyst for bringing that change. And the truth is that the songwriter is the low man or woman on the totem pole in the economic equation, because the three biggest song companies in the world don't advocate for songwriters because they're owned by the three biggest recorded music companies in the world. And on the recorded music side of the business, there's 4/5 of the revenue, there's an 80% gross margin, a 40% net margin. And in general, they own those assets in perpetuity. And conversely, on the song side of the business, you've got 1/5 of the margin, 1/5 of the revenue. And quite rightly, whether it's because of renegotiations or reversions or good management and lawyering in the first place, the songs end up back in the hands of the people that co-created them. We buy directly from those people, but Universal, Warner, and Sony, as those three big companies, use their leverage of recorded music owning songs to A, stop the song company, the publishing company, from advocating for songwriters, and to push as much of the economics towards recorded music, where the lion's share of the money is theirs at the expense of the songwriter. So if we take a typical pound of income from Spotify or from Apple, 30p of that pound is going to Spotify or Apple for their trouble. Now, there's an argument that says that that 30p could become 29 or 27 or 25, and that argument will be made, and I'm sure in due course will be successful, but that's not really the material point. The material point is what happens to the other 70p, and 58.5p of that is going to the recorded music company. They're paying most artists on a sale rather than on a license. So they're paying about 9p out of that 58.5p. So they're clearing almost 50p on every pound. And yet the songwriters, and many songs have as many as 4 or more songwriters on them, and their publishing company are being left to split the remaining 11.5p. That massive disparity of 58.5p versus 11.5p only exists because of the unhealthy control that the three biggest recorded music companies have over owning and controlling their song companies. And we know that this is wrong. The songwriter knows that it's wrong. So we're a catalyst to bring that change, and we're not scared to talk about it, and we're not scared to continually highlight that this is a problem, and to eventually get to a point where we change where the songwriter sits in the economic equation.
But if those three major labels own, correct me if I'm wrong, 2/3 of all music ever made, does that mean you can't get your hands on it very easily?
What we're doing is we're empowering the songwriter. We're making these deals. On the one hand, we're buying out their rights, but we're buying out the rights directly from them, and we're paying fair value for those rights. We have a competitive advantage because we're a real music company at the same time as being an investment company, but we do pay fair prices for the catalogs. But at that point, what's also inherent in that is we've now taken 130 of the most important songwriters in the world, and we've de-risked their futures. They don't have to worry about whether they're in favor with Universal, Warner, or Sony tomorrow in order to be able to pay their bills and live the life that they want. They are now in a position where they can make decisions that are in their own best interest and in the best interest of the songwriting community moving forward. And that's a very, very powerful position to put these people in, because what we see as being important in the first instance is that from this point on, there should never be another negotiation that takes place that can affect how a songwriter is paid, where the songwriter is not represented at the table by themselves. In the past, they've been represented by organizations like the NMPA, which does incredible work under David Israelite. But again, alignment is only there about three quarters of the time because David Israelite represents the publishing community, doesn't represent the songwriting community. And there's crucially 25 or 30% of the time where what's in the best interest of the songwriting community is not necessarily what's in the best interest of the publishing community and vice versa. The songwriter must have a seat at the table. So you're probably familiar that the DCMS, the Department of Culture, Music and Sciences in the UK, has been having parliamentary hearings that we've given important written evidence to. Niall Rogers from our advisory board has appeared before the hearings. And I'm very pleased to say that I think that the MPs that are at the center of those hearings, people like Kevin Brennan and Julian Knight, have done a terrific job of paying attention. And I think that they agree with us that this unhealthy position that the labels have in controlling the recorded music companies, have in controlling the publishing companies, has to change. By the way, I also want to be clear that we see ourselves as catalysts for that change and for being the ones that are going to hold the industry's feet to the fire to bring that change. But the change has to come from Universal, Warner, and Sony. So what I'm quite hopeful of is that someone like Sir Lucian Grange, who's arguably the most famous music executive of all time or the most successful music executive of all time, as he drives Vivendi to what I believe will be an unbelievably successful IPO, this is a company that's going to go from having a 33.5 billion euro valuation to having a 100 billion euro valuation, I think, by this time next year. That once he's done that, and once he's done his duty on behalf of the Vivendi board, I think at that point, he'll then be able to turn around and say, and now we need to make change on behalf of the songwriting community. Because the thing that's very important to point out, of course, is that the songwriter is delivering the most important component. You would not be going to see these great artists play if you didn't love their songs. You wouldn't be wearing the merchandise from an artist if you didn't love their songs. You wouldn't be turning on the television to watch music or radio or have Spotify or Apple if you didn't love the songs. So the one thing that I'm very careful about is to never say anything that no one can argue against. There isn't anyone in this business that can argue against the fact that the songwriter needs to go from being at the bottom of the economic equation to the top. So I'm quite certain that people like Lucian and the people at Warner's like Max Lusada really understand songwriters, or Rob Stringer at Sony, and the people that they work with are going to come to the party and make the change. And as I say, what I am is a catalyst for that. No one was talking about it before we were talking about it, and we won't stop talking about it until it's changed, and we'll continue to empower songwriters and ensure that this change comes.
That is terrific. Now, in our investing business, we talk about stock selection, but yours is a lot about song selection, whether it's Fleetwood Mac or Blondie or, gosh, 10cc, it's a long list of people. So just maybe give us an example. Tell us a little bit about how that process works from identification through to execution.
The identification part of it obviously is easy. As I say, we're talking about songs that for the most part have become a part of the fabric of society. And the judgment call, if there's any judgment call in this, is it culturally important as well? The fact that it's extraordinarily successful, there's data there to demonstrate that it's extraordinarily successful. The cultural importance is a judgment call, but it's a judgment call that I believe demonstrates endurance, that gives you the full benefit of that 70 years after the death of the last co-composer, rule of law, protection on your copyright. But ultimately, everything is borne out by the data, because I talk about the predictability and the reliability of these income streams. We're looking at verified income only. So we're not paying people on where we might be in a year's time or 2 years' time or 5 years' time. There are contingent bonuses in the deals that reward people for our thesis being correct going forward. But when we're buying on historical data. The last 3 years of verified data from both the publishing company, the performing rights society, any other income that might be included in the sale. And if you take a songwriter like The Dream, who wrote Single Ladies Put a Ring on It for Beyonce, Umbrella for Rihanna, All of the Lights for Kanye West, Holy Grail for Jay-Z, Touch My Body from Mariah Carey, a typical statement from Warner Chappell, who was the administrator for The Dream, the company collecting the monies around the world, when we bought the catalog, that typical statement for a 6-month period might be 10,000 pages long and have billions of microtransactions on it. Our job at that point is to go through that unstructured data, create a structured version of it so that we can go through and make sure that there's no lumpiness, there's no income that we don't believe will be repeated in the future, and figure out what the real baseline is for purchasing the catalog. So ultimately, it's from the perspective of any other asset class that your listeners may be familiar with, there's an unbelievable amount of data that backs up the predictability and reliability of these great songs.
So you're selecting the songs, but then you got this song management. So I think I read that you got Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas to be used by Marks and Spencer's for their Christmas adverts. If you got a whole team of people who are focusing on sweating the asset.
Of course, we don't like the term sweating the asset, because that sounds unbelievably like you're doing something that's not in the best interest of the song. What we're doing is actually putting bandwidth into them, because these great songs, famous as though they may be, when they've been in houses that have 20,000 songs per person, they've been allowed to languish. So if you look at our Eurythmics catalog, there are 32 UK hits singles in our Eurythmics catalog, but only 4 of them show up at the time of acquisition in any meaningful way as far as the data is concerned, because they've been allowed to languish. Because if you go to the old publishing company and you ask for Eurythmics, someone's going to give you the easy answer of, oh, we've got Sweet Dreams Are Made of This. If you push them really, really hard, they might say, oh yeah, we've got Here Comes the Rain Again as well. But the truth is that there are 30 other amazing songs in the Eurythmics catalog. In fact, there's 60 or 70 other amazing songs in the Eurythmics catalog and more, but there's actually 30 others that were hits that the public knows and loves and they're a part of the fabric of our society. Our job is to bring them back to life. So we treat each of these songs as a business of its own. We create a P&L for each one of them, not to institutionalize them, but to just give us basic data that makes us either believe that the song is performing optimally or that forces us to then say, no, we need to do better with this song. We need to put a plan of action in place. Let's figure out what movie we can put it in. Let's figure out what TV commercial we can put it in. Let's figure out what new artists could sing the song. So in the case of Mariah Carey and Marks and Spencer's, that's not quite right. It was actually Debbie Harry and Blondie that ended up in the Marks and Spencer's commercial. But Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You went to number one for the first time in its 26-year life under our management, with great effort on the Sony team's behalf and a great effort on our behalf as well, to just dot the I's and cross the T's and get it across the board. But certainly now what that means, so in the case of Blondie and Debbie Harry, one way or another ends up in the Marks and Spencer's ad. Heart of Glass ends up at the heart of a TikTok campaign that we do where Miley Cyrus covers Heart of Glass and brings it to a whole new generation of younger people. She then ends up, as a result of the success on it, because we were able to sign up over 1 million people to Blondie's TikTok subscription page, Miley then ends up putting it on her own album, her new album, which came out last November. And suddenly the song's got a whole new lease of life and has been in the Spotify viral top 50 literally every day since the end of October.
So you mentioned TikTok. I see you've done work with Peloton. How is technology going to change the music business in the next decade?
Well, all of these things are, we talked earlier about streaming and how we've gone from being a discretionary purchase for music to now being a utility purchase. Inherent in that is that the vast majority of those people that are now paying $10 a month or £10 a month are not a part of the data on which we buy these catalogs. So in many ways, it's found money. The same thing is true of all these new uses of music. You know, consumption of music is at the heart of every product today. If you're using Peloton or you're using Tonal or these other new exercise systems in the US that are permeating to the rest of the world, the consumption of music is essential to that experience. You buy a new car today, and one of the features that they really highlight is that you can connect your smartphone and play whatever music that you want in that. You buy a watch, and they tell you that you can, again, listen to your favorite streaming service. So the consumption of music, whether it's on TikTok, whether it's on Peloton, whether it's via Facebook or Triller or any of these other methods, all of which are becoming legitimized and very strong deals are being put in place. What's very interesting about this is that almost all consumption of music in 2021 is paid consumption of music. Whereas if you went back to 2008, one of the things that we talk about is the fact that these revenues are uncorrelated and people are consuming whether in good times or bad. And certainly we've proven that during the course of the pandemic, where not only did we become a FTSE 250 company in January of 2020, but by the time you get to the end of March, beginning of April, with the pandemic in full swing, we're the number 23 biggest yielder on the index. In that entire period of time now, almost a year later, we've been somewhere between number 23 and number 35 consistently in terms of biggest yielders on the index at a point in time when other great blue chip companies have not been able to pay their dividends or have had to cut them. We've been growing our dividend and we've covered it completely. But the interesting thing about all of this is that it's true that music was uncorrelated in 2008 when there was a financial crisis and people were looking for escape and comfort as well. But at that point in time, most consumption of music was not being paid for because people had illegal downloading. Today, the convenience of streaming and all of these other products that have music at the center of them, this is all paid consumption.
So I get the upside, but the investing business is about calibrating risk and rewards. And how do you think about the risks in this sphere?
When you look at the different levers, one, we're buying at attractive prices in the first instance because of the fact that there was illegal downloading and the revenues were decimated. You then look at the fact that we had 30 million paid subscribers to music streaming services less than 3 years ago. We now have 450 million and we're projected to have 2 billion by the end of the decade. You've got legislation that's taking place all over the world, in the US, in the UK, that is voting a greater share of the pie to the songwriter. So the Copyright Board in the United States, which is a judicial board that passes into law how a songwriter is paid, voted a raise of 44% to the songwriter in 2018 to be paid out incrementally between 2018 and the end of 2022. That will then continue at that level from 2022 on. So a dollar's worth of income that we bought is now worth $1.44 by the time we get to the end of 2022. When you then add in that we're able to actively manage these catalogs better and bring efficiencies to the collections of the monies, all of this paints the way for a very safe new asset class that's delivering big results. So when you look at our results to date, last year, we've had a total return to our shareholders of 23%. We've outperformed the FTSE 250 by that same level. Since inception, a 41.9% total return to investors. Again, having outperformed the FTSE 250 by about 40%. And you look at the way that discount rates are narrowing because of this shift from being a discretionary luxury purchase to being a utility purchase, it paints a very, very rosy picture for the future.
I was curious, your Hipgnosis is a UK-listed company and it's a closed-end fund. One would have thought instinctively it might have been able to gain immediately greater traction in the US. So why the UK? Question number one. Why closed-end fund number two?
From the perspective of the UK, my feeling very, very strongly was that music plays a much more important role in the day-to-day life of the average Brit than it plays anywhere else in the world. You can credit Radio One with that. You can credit BBC Television and its history of everything from Top of the Pops through to the Graham Norton Show. You can credit Weekly Musical Press when it existed. You can credit Monthly Musical Press, but the UK knows and loves its music. Something like Glastonbury Festival is a great example of this, where families will look forward to the entire year. And we look forward to 2022, when I hope that Glastonbury is back in full swing post-pandemic. But my feeling was that music plays a more important role in the day-to-day life of the average Brit. And therefore, the understanding of this as an asset class and the logic behind it would resonate. And that's true. We've now, between both equity and leverage, have raised the better part of 1.6, 1.7 billion pounds. 1.3 of that is equity. The balance is leverage. That equity, 99.9% of it is all from the UK. We've only just begun to talk to US investors and investors from around the world. In terms of why a closed-ended trust, because there's a decades-old construct there with some of the finest institutional investors in the world that effectively allows you to have permanent capital. I could have done this as private equity and made more money for myself, but ultimately the drawbacks with private equity were, A, there would be a real ceiling on investment. That might have been 500 million pounds. It might have been 1 billion pounds if I was extraordinarily successful, but it certainly wouldn't have been much more than that. Equally well, there would be a term on the money, whether that was 5-year money or 7-year money. And what was very clear to me was that both constructs would work from the perspective of making money for myself and my shareholders. But in private equity, my ulterior motive of changing where the songwriter sits in the economic equation might go out the window if the investors decided that they wanted their money out before that goal was achieved. Whereas doing it as a closed-ended trust, doing it on the London stock market, going in 3 years from being a normal listing to being a premier listing based on success, to being a FTSE 250 company, and then being one of the biggest yielders on the index, puts us in a very good position to not only make money for our shareholders and ourselves, but to also pull off that goal of changing where the songwriter sits in the economic equation as well.
So I get that. I absolutely get the investment case. I'm also thinking, what do listeners want? Although when I ask that question, I think I'm reminded of Henry Ford, who once said, if I'd asked the public what they'd like, they would have said faster horses. Does the public know what they want?
At the end of the day, we live, particularly in a post-COVID world, where the public is looking for alternative opportunities to invest their money that can provide a great return on their money. And music, as I say, is something that they actually know and understand and that resonates with them. And to some degree, it's an opportunity to invest and to also be proud of what you're investing in as well. So when you can turn around and say that I've got my money in Neil Young, and I've got my money in Nile Rodgers, and I've got my money in Dave Stewart and the Eurythmics, and I've got my money in Mark Ronson, and I've got my money in Timbaland, and I've got my money in Fleetwood Mac and Lindsey Buckingham, I think that this is something that really resonates with the public as well as with the institutional investors.
I am an incredibly unmusical. However, my wife is part of a band called Stax, and they've sung with Steve Winwood at Cornbury and a few others. And I've now got two daughters, both at university, both writing songs, and they're out there on Spotify and SoundCloud. What advice would you give to young singers hoping to make it?
We are in a world now, and this is why our work on behalf of the songwriting community is so important, where every artist is working with outside songwriters. There hasn't been a Billboard Top 100 album of the year since 2014 that didn't have an outside songwriter on it. Bob Dylan's last album, But One, was the last album that didn't have an outside songwriter on it. So whether you're a songwriter, you're coming at it from the songwriting perspective, then you need to ensure that you've got great partners to work with, that you can bounce ideas off the back of, and great performers to sing those songs. And these people are probably not that far from you. There's great songwriters and great performers pretty much everywhere in the world. You just have to work hard to find them. The big advantage today, of course, is that you can literally record a song, write a song this week, record it next week, and put it up on Spotify or put it up on Apple through an aggregator, and the public can immediately begin talking back and tell you whether or not they like your song. So what you have to be prepared for is that so much of the work today needs to be done by the songwriter and the artist and the producer to get from not just point A to point B, but from point A to B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, because the big record companies, when they have an artist walk through the door, they expect them to have 20,000 Instagram followers and a million plays on Spotify, because they're not investing. You know, in the past, when I started in this business, you just had to show that there was a hint of a good song there and a hint of attitude and a hint of style, and someone would take a bet on you, because that's what you were able to do without having hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds of investment put behind you. Now the business expects you to have demonstrated to some great degree real stickiness between you and your audience before they'll take a chance on you. So you've got to go out and search for those songwriters. You've got to go out and search for those performers and those producers that will help you make the right songs. And at the same time, you've got to make visuals for yourself and have people filming you all the time and put content out on your social media and demonstrate that not only is there connectivity between you and the public, but that the public also approves of what you're doing.
It's as hard as podcasting.
It is indeed. We're spoiled for choice.
So I've got a few closing questions. On your fantastically interesting journey, who's inspired you the most?
Joe Strummer would probably be my biggest inspiration as far as an artist giving me a blueprint for the future. Neil Young would be equal on that path. Obviously, from a musical point of view, the Beatles, from the Beatles to Hendrix to Kraftwerk, etc. But the two people that have been a part of my life that have inspired me the most that are not family or friends would be Elton and Nile Rodgers. And that's just because in both cases, our relationship was based on a love of music and our own personal consumption of music and turning each other on to music. Elton and I would start the day off at 8 o'clock in the morning. And the first question would be, what are you listening to? Nile and I are very, very similar. We were talking earlier and we're talking about Eric Dolphy records or Grant Green records or something like that. In today's instance, we were talking about the Brothers Johnson and Quincy Jones's amazing productions.
And if you could have lunch with two musicians who aren't your clients, but you'd like them to be, who would they be and where would you have lunch?
Do they both have to be alive?
No.
I would love to have lunch with Joe Strummer. I would love to have lunch with Brian Wilson. I would love to have lunch with Carol Bayer Sager. I would love to have lunch with Robbie Robertson. I would love to have lunch with Mick Jones from both The Clash and from Foreigner. I could go on and on and on and on all day. Lunch would probably take place at Vinny and Piero's on Poland Street or at Cafe Pacifico. I'm a vegan, so I have my vegan spots. If it was in Los Angeles, it's probably at the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel or at Merrick's Tex-Mex. Anyone that has good vegan food and a nice atmosphere.
And if you were advising a 20-year-old about this business, would you encourage them to go into the music business?
Absolutely. This is maybe the biggest testament to what we're doing, what's happening in music as a whole. And I say this all the time, 5 years ago, I would not have been able to look a 20-year-old in the eye and say that the best days of the music industry are in front of it. I might have still encouraged them to go into it because, of course, the love of music and a passion for it is everything. But now not only can I encourage them to go into it, but I can encourage them to go into it knowing full well that the best days of the music industry are in front of it. The best days of songs are in front of them. It's what's so magical about what we've been able to create for our shareholders is that we're literally buying songs, as I say, at a 15 times average multiple. And I think that in the next 5 years, we're going to see 40 times multiples of what are much, much fatter income streams than what we've bought at, because the best days of the music industry are definitely in front of it.
I got a slightly different question. As I did some research for this interview, I came across a really nice line from a song. I'm hoping that if I quote it, you'll tell me who wrote it.
Uh-oh. I'm on the spot.
If you've got the money, honey, I got the time. And when you run out of money, honey, I run out of time.
I know exactly what that is. It's not my song. I wish it was my song. But you can look at so many. Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown, wrote Money, the original. It was later covered by the Flying Lizards and made very famous in the UK. But it was originally by Barrett Strong. The concept of music and money going hand in hand has been there from time immemorial, I would say. And Berry Gordy is someone that is absolutely a role model for so many people. A man of color brought music to the world and that brought these incredible Motown songs to the world. So no, I love it. Thank you.
So Mert, that has been a fantastic conversation. We haven't covered this topic on the Money Mess podcast before. I'm really, really pleased that we have. And I'm going to take away two things. Music as an investing category is here to stay and it needs some attention. And we have a lot of long-term investors from pension funds to family offices and other gatekeepers who I would suggest want to take a look at this and look at your business and understand the space more. And for youth, music has possibly one of the most exciting trajectories than we can remember.
You're absolutely correct. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for reminding me of Lefty Frizzell. And if everyone can, please listen to If You've Got the Money, Honey, I've Got the Time. And now I'm gonna go and see if I can find Lefty Frizzell's estate and buy that song.
Fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to having lunch with you in Notting Hill when all this stuff is over. So good luck. Thank you, Merck. And we'll be in touch.
All the best, mate.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.